we're taking a closer look at political tribalism on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The partial government shutdown is the longest in U.S. history. At the one-month mark, there have been a number of public opinion polls examining how Americans feel about the shutdown and who is to blame. According to a PBS NewsHour Marist poll, 7 in 10 Americans said shutting down the federal government in order to reach an agreement on government policy is a bad strategy. So do you find yourself in an us versus them mindset in politics, at work, and in life? And if so, what do you think is behind this? Do you always support your political side even when you may not agree with party leaders? The number is 800-642-1234. Let's talk about this on email at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Daniel Stalder is a psychology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and he recently wrote about political tribalism for Psychology Today. And his book is The Power of Context, How to Manage Our Bias and Improve Our Understanding of Others. Daniel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, so help us out with a working definition for tribalism. How should we view it? How should we put a framework around it?
Well, as far as a framework goes, I have a story that I tell, or at the start of one of my articles in Psychology Today, I told the story of a Kentucky graduation ceremony. Basically, you could think of tribalism as cheering for everything that your side says until you learn that the other side said it. And what happened at this graduation ceremony is that this valedictorian was giving a speech, and he shared an inspirational quote and attributed that inspirational quote to a political party leader, and the audience cheered. And then the valedictorian said, "Oh, wait a minute. Actually, it was the leader of the other political party." And then the cheers quickly died down and even turned to groans. And this can happen in Washington, too. I think that the Democrats are probably more anti-Russia now than they were before Trump became president. And when Obama was president, the Republicans were, you know, against more things than they were before.
So this high school graduation speech, it went viral on the internet. You say that this incident appeared to be something called reactive devaluation. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Reactive devaluation actually is a very specific concept that refers to exactly what I just described, where you will cheer for what your side says, you will support what your side says, but then if suddenly you find out that the other side is also in favor of it, or that it actually originated from the other side, then you have this reactance. You have this negative reactive response where you change your mind. But this is just one of sort of one corner of tribalism. I was going to share a more academic definition of tribalism as a group loyalty, where you love your side, you vote for your side. You dislike the other side, you vote against the other side. And this is when you belong to or self-identify with a group. It's when this group is central to your identity. In both your belief and your behavior, you go along with your fellow group members and you go along with your group leader, and sometimes you do so blindly. I think you kind of alluded to that in your intro, that you will, you know, go along with your group even if you don't necessarily privately agree with your group leader. And part of this means that you're going to blame the other side, and that you're going to attack the critics of your group leader. So this is very much an us versus them mentality, which I think you also mentioned. And that's very much part of the in-group, out-group dynamics of tribalism.
So Daniel Stalder, where might tribalism crop up in our lives outside of politics?
Outside of politics, it depends on the group that you're talking about. If you belong to a particular religious group, for example, and you strongly self-identify with that religious group, then you may go along with what your minister or priest or pastor says, even if, you know, you don't personally agree with it, or even if you have not agreed with it in the past. And I guess there are some historic rivalries, or there are some historic conflicts between certain religious groups, and so you might be against that other religious group, and you might, just as a knee-jerk reaction, not agree with what those religious leaders are saying.
We're talking with Daniel Stalder. He's a professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. You can join the conversation. Do you always support your political side, even when you may not agree with party leaders? How do you try and bridge the gap between you and people with different political beliefs? And has it worked? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel, is tribalism just a natural human behavior, or is this something we've learned, or is it innate?
That's a great question that I've been asked before, and my best answer is that it's probably a little bit of all of the above. The thing about comparing those potential causes is that instinct, which is part of evolution, you didn't say evolution, but to say that it's innate or to say that it's natural, that reflects an evolutionary process. And that's one of the hardest things to prove. That's one of the hardest things to do a research study on. Evolution happens over, you know, many hundreds of thousands of years, and so you can't exactly run a control group to see exactly, you know, what's causing what. However, the second answer you mentioned, is it learned? Yeah, I think as far as the research evidence goes, it's very much learned, that we learn from an early age that there are benefits to going along with your group. There are pros and cons, you know, to being tribalistic. There are pros and cons to showing in-group favoritism. And one of the pros, one of the benefits, is that you get this mutual support. You get this sense of belonging. It's sort of a boost to your ego. And so as far as behavioral conditioning is concerned, when we do things that have rewards attached to them, then we're more likely to keep doing those behaviors, and it's not necessarily even consciously. And then, of course, we want to avoid the punishments of not going along with our group. If we do not go along with our group, then we might get punished in various ways. Our friends might stop talking to us, or we might not get invited to the, you know, really good parties that our friends are throwing, you know, just in terms of a teenage example. But learned is probably the best answer, because research can most support that. But just because evolution is hard to document with bona fide research studies, that doesn't mean it's also not happening. And so I think the best answer is that it's probably somewhat instinctual and then definitely learned.
It seems, too, that it might be easier to go with your tribe, to gravitate toward tribalism, because the payoffs perhaps seem easier in a way, or they're more accessible.
Yeah, cognitively speaking, it's very easy to go with your tribe. If you're trying to decide whom to vote for in an election, if you haven't had time or motivation to read the newspaper or to listen to the speeches, but you are a longtime Democrat or you are a longtime Republican, well, then you can just do a straight party ticket. There's not much thought involved in that. That's partly what you mean. But you also probably have friends and family and peers who are in that group also, and you trust them, and so it makes sense without a whole lot of thinking to just go along with them, sure.
Like so many issues in the U.S., the partial government shutdown is viewed very differently by people in different partisan and ideological camps. We're talking about political tribalism with Daniel Stalder. He's a psychology professor at UW-Whitewater. He's been blogging about this for Psychology Today. In a new Pew Research Center survey, about 6 in 10 adults called the shutdown a very serious problem. So what do you think about political tribalism? 800-642-1234. How do you try and bridge the gap between you and people with different political beliefs? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up this discussion in just a minute on the Ideas Network. Reporters at the Washington Post called the partial government shutdown a beached whale, stuck in place with no apparent way back to the water. Even though most voters blame President Trump for the shutdown, neither side in Washington has much incentive to compromise. And we're taking a closer look at what impact political tribalism has to do with it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, gathering your insights at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself locked in an us versus them mindset in politics? Do you find these hardened divisions in other areas of your life? What do you think is behind this? And what do you do about it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Daniel Stalder is our guide. He's a UW Whitewater psychology professor. He's been writing about political tribalism for Psychology Today. Daniel, let's talk about our current government shutdown, which is now the longest in our nation's history. We're at about 31 days. You say that there are multiple factors behind the shutdown, but tribalism is a major reason it's lasted this long. Why do you think that is?
Well, tribalism is actually multifaceted. Psychologically speaking, there are several mechanisms that underlie tribalism, and one of my articles highlighted three of those mechanisms. One of them is groupthink, another one is called group centrism, and another one is called naive realism. And I can start with naive realism. This is where you think your way of looking at the world, and in terms of the group level, we in our group, we think that our way of looking at the world is the correct way, it's the objective way. And the other group, they're biased, they're not rational, they're not looking at things correctly. And that's a mentally healthy way to be to a degree. In moderation, it's good for our egos, it's good for our mental health to think that, you know, we can see things objectively. But by extension, if other people are not seeing things objectively, you can see how there's going to be conflict. And that's part of what you see in tribalism. The groupthink phenomenon, I mean, that goes back decades. I think a big example textbooks talk about is with JFK and the decision that he made to invade Cuba, and it turned out to be a really bad decision, and a lot of people died. And in retrospect, JFK and psychologists thought, what went wrong? Why did we make this decision when this was a really bad decision? And some of the analysis suggested that groupthink was going on. And part of what groupthink means is that if there are any members of your group that start to question the leader, then it's the job of the group to punish those dissenters or to pressure those dissenters to get into line. And I think that's partly what's going on with some of our group dynamics in Washington right now, where I don't want to claim to read the minds of any particular Republican politician, but there are some Republicans who are voicing disagreement with Trump about how to go about this current impasse. And some of those Republican representatives are saying, let's get the government open, let's actually do a temporary spending bill, and then let's talk about border security. And then Trump had a meeting, from what I read, Trump had a meeting with these Republicans and tried to get them back in line. And, you know, and I don't know exactly what happened in that meeting, but I think that the Republican dissenters did stop publicly dissenting after that to some degree.
Let's bring in a call. Now let's go to Tom joining us from Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to chime in on this. I think part of tribalism comes from not knowing one's history. And I'll give you a perfect example. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and many people don't know that the Republican Party was formed here in Wisconsin as an anti-slavery party. And it, what happens is, not knowing your history, we can easily become bogged down in what is currently happening rather than historically what these different organizations stand for.
Tom, thanks for the call. What about being history-minded here, Daniel?
I think being history-minded could be really helpful. I know that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party historically have appeared quite opposite to how they appear today, and that may be part of what the caller was referring to. So on the one hand, what happened 40, 60, 80 years ago may not be relevant to what's happening right now, because parties change, the members of the parties change, and we have to deal with what the members of the parties are saying and doing right now. On the other hand, what I think I like about Tom, was it?
Yeah.
What, yes, I think I like about his comment is that if we could step back and think, what were these parties like further back in time, and were they different, and were they broader in their goals? I just think that awareness might actually soften, maybe for some of us, it might soften some of our aggressive attitude toward each other. That's a possibility anyway. That's partly why I appreciate that comment.
Let's bring in Russ now, joining us from Stoughton. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning. I wanted to make a comment regarding your guest's use of the term tribal mentality, and it's kind of a, maybe that's a new kind of modern day label, but in my eyes, it's no different than gang mentality, of which I was part of one back in the 60s before I was forced into the Army. And it's basically, you go along with the authority of the group, the political group or the gang, and whether you like people or even respect them, you are told that these are people that you totally have to be against. And I don't think that's changed in 100 years or maybe even longer than that. You know, it's like these people are bad. We say they're bad. You're supposed to think they're bad or against you or whatever, whether you respect them or even like them. You're not supposed to be in their favor.
Well, let's get Daniel there to respond. Is tribalism have any connection with being a member of a gang?
I suppose at an extreme. Well, first of all, tribalism is not all that psychological. In other words, when I look in my social psychology textbooks, I don't actually see tribalism, but I do see its components like groupthink and naive realism and the things that I was talking about before. And so tribalism, maybe it's not in the social psychology textbooks because it is kind of an extreme term, and so maybe Ross's point makes sense that there are some aspects of gang mentality that do overlap with tribal mentality, and that's why calling other people tribalistic, that's why calling the other side tribalistic is an insult. I think Jeff Nunberg wrote for NPR about a year ago how groups are starting to use the tribal label as an insult in attacking each other and undermining their positions. So, yeah, I think at an extreme, tribalism shares some of what Ross is describing in terms of you go with your leader and you must be against the other side. And, you know, I want to caution everybody, including myself, that just because you strongly identify with a group, just because you strongly identify even with a political group, and even if you're a high-profile politician, that doesn't mean you're tribalistic. You can vote with your group and still not be tribalistic in these, you know, extreme irrational ways. It's hard to read the mind of any particular politician, and so, you know, let's not assume that just because someone's voting with their group that they're definitely behaving in a tribalistic manner.
Has political tribalism gotten worse in recent years, or perhaps we're just more aware of it?
So I'm not a historian or a political scientist, but I would say, just based on my awareness of what's been going on politically, that at least in the recent past, I would say tribalism is a lot worse today. I'm going to guess that over the decades, you know, it's increased and decreased, so it's probably been cyclical to some degree, but definitely in the last 10 or 12 years, I would say tribalism is getting worse, just based on what's happening in federal or Washington politics, at least.
We had Paul from Eau Claire who emailed to say that President Trump doesn't belong to any tribal party. Neither Republicans nor Democrats like him. And that's why Paul likes President Trump. So what goes through your mind when you hear something like that?
Based on what I've read and based on what I've observed of Trump, he does represent a unique political figure in the way that I think Paul is referring to him. On the other hand, in this recent shutdown, Trump was originally going to go with the Democrat and Republican temporary spending bill. There was that temporary spending bill that was passed in the Senate, and it was going to keep the government open. And the reason Trump suddenly reversed on that was because, I mean, we can't read Trump's mind, but in terms of the order in which things happened, there were conservative leaders in talk radio and cable news. These conservative leaders told Trump not to go with the temporary spending bill. They told Trump to fight for the wall, and then Trump made the reversal, and he started fighting for the wall. And so I'm guessing that Trump was following the conservative leaders in that example, even if not necessarily Republican leaders.
We're talking about the concept of tribalism and whether it cuts to the heart of our country's deep divisions. Studying political tribalism with Daniel Stalder. He's a professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater and recently blogged about political tribalism for Psychology Today. Is identity politics to blame here? Are Americans divided into hard shell groups of tribes based on their race, religion, and sexual identities? Talk about it, 800-642-1234, back after the news on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what political tribalism is and where we see it today in our lives. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Politicians worry openly about tribalism. Former Arizona Senator Jeff Flakes has said tribalism is ruining us. Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse wrote a book warning that partisan tribalism is statistically higher than at any point since the Civil War. And then last September, then-House Speaker Paul Ryan said he worried society is becoming deinstitutionalized, which he attributed in part to identity politics and tribalism.
21st century technology has proven that tribalism and identity politics is effective. More to the point, which is even worse, people make money off of it.
So what do you think? Are you concerned about political tribalism in American politics? Do you think tribalism is at the heart of differences, or is it something else that is undergirding these deep divisions? Let's explore this further with your perspective at 800-642-1234. Daniel Stalder stays with us. He's a professor of psychology at UW-Wisconsin-Whitewater, and he recently blogged about political tribalism for Psychology Today. Daniel, let's talk a little bit about the media's role in tribalism. Where do you see the media fitting into this?
The media definitely plays a role, probably in multiple aspects. I guess I'm going to start by discussing the partisan cable news channels. There's Fox News that a majority of Republicans watch, and then there's MSNBC that the liberals watch. And in themselves, they may not be a problem, I suppose, but my point is that a lot of Republicans just watch Fox News and they don't watch other channels. And a lot of liberals just watch MSNBC. In fact, it's not perfectly equivalent, although liberals are much more likely to watch MSNBC. They're also a little more likely to watch a number of news sources and not just MSNBC. But my point is that Fox News is a partisan news source, and so is MSNBC. And so if all you do is watch those shows, or if you primarily watch those shows, then you're going to get a slanted perspective on the political groups involved. But social media is another way we could talk about the role of media, with Twitter and Facebook and those other social media platforms. Messages are being sent with more anonymity, and when you're anonymous or when you're more anonymous, then it's easier to be nasty and it's easier to be uncivil. I think you had someone on your show a couple of weeks ago that talked about civil discourse and how that seems to be breaking down. And one of the reasons civil discourse is breaking down is because of the social media context. And if we could communicate more civilly, I think that could help reduce tribalism, actually. Well, okay, let me say one more thing.
Sure, go ahead.
The mainstream news kind of gets a bad rap, and I just wanted to share some of what I've read in terms of the reviews of the research. The mainstream news, according to meta-analyses and other large-scale investigations, the mainstream news is a lot more balanced than most people think. I know there's a reputation that it's liberally biased, but I just want to encourage all of us to give mainstream news more of a chance. It's more balanced than most people think.
Well, let's look at overcoming tribalism, or if that's even possible. How do we work on being more open and less entrenched in our side?
So that's a huge question, and I actually have a number of ways to answer that. Maybe with the time we have left, I'll focus on what I talked about in my book. My book is about biases of jumping to conclusions about each other, and I think that's part of tribalism, that you make quick assumptions about the other side, you know, especially when you're in some kind of a debate situation. When people disagree with us, we have a tendency to think they are biased or that they are willfully ignorant, and they might be, but it's not necessary that they are. I think we jump to that conclusion too quickly. So the point I'm getting to is that at the end of my book, I mentioned 15 strategies to help reduce that kind of bias. And one of the strategies is to learn about the biases. And so listening to this show, hopefully, and reading more about tribalism and reading more about the related biases, that can help to reduce the biases. Slowing down your thinking is my main suggestion. Try not to jump to conclusions means slow down. If someone's angering you, try to take a step back. You don't have to decide if this other person is willfully ignorant right away. You can finish listening to what they have to say, and then you can still decide whether they're being willfully ignorant or whether they're, you know, doing something that you think is wrong. There's also empathy training that can help. Mindfulness training can help in a lot of ways. And I'm not an expert in mindfulness, but I've learned more about it in order to write my book. And so I could talk a little more about that if there's time.
And so really being present, it sounds like, and understanding and listening in the moment to the situation at hand before jumping to conclusions. However, our brain wants to jump to conclusions. Our brains, aren't we wired to be thinking ahead?
It depends. If we are under stress, if we are under a heavy cognitive load while we're making these decisions, while we're talking to somebody, then yes, we're very likely to want to make a decision quickly and want to decide what we think about this other person right away. And I'm not sure how natural it is, but definitely when we're under stress or high cognitive load, that's the case. And so there are strategies to slow ourselves down. The proverbial counting to 10 can help. It really can. And it also, I've also read that just regular exercise and regular sleep, that also helps our self-control so that we can resist the urge to jump to a decision right away.
What would be your best advice to our elected officials right now to counter this tribalism and perhaps work to end this government shutdown?
Wow, okay. I don't know how much I can put myself in the place of the politicians who are making these decisions. I mean, some of my suggestions are certainly worth passing on to them. I'm just acknowledging that, you know, they have responsibilities or perceived responsibilities that I don't have in my day-to-day life. In terms of this shutdown, I wrote at the end of one of my blog articles that from what I've read, the Republicans are beginning to splinter a little bit. There are reports that they're privately disagreeing with the course of action that Trump is taking, and some of them are publicly disagreeing with it. And I haven't read quite as much or at all that the Democrats are splintering. And so, you know, this is going to sound like a partisan answer, but since the Republicans are already splintering, what I recommended at the end of my article is that we try to push that a little bit more. The thing is, one of the symptoms of groupthink is an illusion of unanimity, where you think your party is more unified than it actually is. And so I'm thinking if more public comments are made about certain Republicans not being on the same page, some of them being ready to do a temporary spending bill, that might be our quickest way out of this. But in terms of tribalism in general, you know, if politicians have control over this, I think there should be less gerrymandering within the states. There should be less big money in politics. Those are big, tall orders, but those are long-term solutions maybe to reducing tribalism.
Earlier, you touched on social media and our behavior on social media. Does that factor into how we see ourselves because of that anonymity in posting those messages and being able to respond so quickly? Do we lose all of the things that would help us be less tribal?
I wouldn't say we lose all of the things that make us less tribal, but yeah, I suppose the anonymity is a big one. One of the strategies that I mentioned in my book to reduce bias is to remove that anonymity, and more than that, to increase our accountability. Increasing accountability in a daily sense means try to justify your decision, try to justify your vote, try to justify your opinion of the other side to somebody else, not just to yourself. And maybe even try to justify your opinion to somebody else, to that other person. And research shows that if you take those steps to hold yourself accountable, that reduces bias. And in social media, especially, you know, because of the anonymity, that's definitely not present. But do we lose ourselves? So yeah, I guess we could to some degree. It depends on the individual, because some individuals use their real name and they take accountability for what they're saying.
Daniel, if we could do one thing today to help address political tribalism, what step would that be that we could take today?
One step, I guess I would have to repeat what I said about slowing down our judgments. And this is easier said than done, of course. If you have the courage to watch the other news channel, you know, if you normally watch Fox News, try to watch MSNBC. If you normally watch MSNBC, try to watch Fox News. And I understand that might be a really hard thing to do. It might even be nauseating for some people to do that. But if we were to do that, to try to hear what the other side is saying, try to slow down your thinking. Try to let the person finish their conversation, finish their points that they're making. Yeah, I don't know how realistic that is, but just slowing down our judgments, trying not to jump to conclusions. Some of us might feel like we have so much information about the other side at this point that slowing down just doesn't make sense. And so I guess my advice is more on a one-on-one basis, that if you're talking to an uncle or you're talking to a friend or you're talking to somebody on Facebook, just try to slow down your judgment about that person.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Daniel Stalder is a professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. He blogged about political tribalism for Psychology Today, and his book is The Power of Context: How to Manage Our Bias and Improve Our Understanding of Others. Coming up, we examine MLK Day and what this National Day of Service means here in Wisconsin with a conversation with the president of the Urban League of Greater Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was established as a federal holiday in 1983. It was designated a National Day of Service by Congress 25 years ago. And since then, volunteer groups have turned the third Monday in January into a day on, not a day off. Let's bring in Reuben Anthony Jr. He is president of the Urban League of Greater Madison. That organization advocates to ensure African Americans and community members are educated, advance in their jobs, and contribute to the common good. Reuben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you today.
Well, let's talk about your personal story. What makes this holiday so meaningful to you?
No, for me, Dr. King's holiday is meaningful because I see myself as a civil rights baby. I was born in 1962. And for my family, they left the Jim Crow South in 1961, and I was the first one of any of my parents' siblings to be born outside of the South. So I feel like I benefited most from not being in the Jim Crow South, but at the same time, I was also old enough to take advantage of the benefits that King and those guys fought for. And when we talk about civil rights, we talk about human rights, we talk about education rights, I was able to avail myself of many of those things that came about from the civil rights struggle. I was a first-generation college student. I had an opportunity to complete my education at Marquette University under the Education Opportunity Program. And from there, I was able to get three other college degrees. So, you know, when King talks about he has a dream, you know, for people having better lives, I think I'm a recipient of the dream. I've got a chance to move from poverty to the middle class. I got a chance to experience home ownership, business ownership, and I've got an opportunity to be in a good position to provide for my children. Had it not been for civil rights, had it not been for the dream, you know, I would not have experienced these things that I experienced today in America.
Reuben, how much did your parents tell you or implant in you what they had endured in their growing up and how differently you had it, and yet there was still much, so much work to do?
Yeah, my parents believe that after the passing of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, that I had a different opportunity than they had. And my parents encouraged me to make the best of it, you know, to believe in America and to believe that the gains that had been gotten from the Civil Rights Act were real, and that if I applied myself each and every day, that the dream could become a reality and that I could move from poverty to the middle class. I could be whatever I wanted to be in America. And so Dr. Martin Luther King had this dream, and he said he might not be there when these things came about, but for the next generations, he hoped for this dream. And so I see myself as a part of the realization of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream, and my parents encouraged that. They encouraged me to go out and do my best, believe in the advances that were made, and take advantage of those advances.
What does Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy mean here in Wisconsin? Where do you see it alive in Wisconsin?
So I'll tell you this way. You know, King's dream today is not simply relegated to black people, but could be viewed as how we collectively have evolved as a people and as a nation. You know, a critical question that we might ask in regards to where we are in Wisconsin is, are we more just today? Because justice was an important concept for Dr. King. And so, but I wonder when I see political attempts in Wisconsin to restrict voters' rights, you know, a lot of the things that we see happening with voting reminds you of things from the Jim Crow South. I wonder about this when I see gerrymandered voting districts in this state and us being the poster children for gerrymandering across the nation. Voters' rights was important for King, and I think we got an issue there. When you ask the question today, are we better off collectively as a people when we see an incoming governor's power restricted in a partisan manner after he's just been elected? And I wonder about Wisconsin. And in regards to race, are we better or at a better place today in Wisconsin when we are leading the nation in black-white disparity statistics, whether it's education, whether it's housing and poverty, we're at the top. So when you look through a lens of justice and equity, King's message is more relevant for Wisconsin today than ever.
We're talking with Reuben Anthony Jr. He's president of the Urban League of Greater Madison, and looking at the significance of MLK Day here in Wisconsin and across the country. Reuben, which of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s lessons are most pressing today in your eyes?
So, I think that, you know, King talked about, you know, fairness and justice. And he talked about voters' rights, you know, and he wanted us to have equality, freedom, justice, and civil rights. So I can't pick among those, but I will tell you that justice and human rights are just as important, you know, today as they were during his time. And one of the things that King said is injustice anywhere, the threat to justice everywhere. But I think even beyond Wisconsin, but as an international concept, that still rings today. I think about Jamal Khashoggi, the columnist from the Washington Post. You know, I mean, for something like that to happen, you know, to someone today in this world, I think, is just appalling, and that we ought to be crying out really loud, you know, about those types of things. So we can't sit back and remain quiet, you know, on certain issues. We have to stand up and make some noise when we see these injustices still persisting today.
Let's take a moment to look at the border wall situation and immigration. Where do you see the U.S. falling short on King's vision in your perspective?
Yeah, I think that we're falling short in terms of, you know, staying silent, you know, on some of King's vision. I don't think that we can stay silent on the border wall. I think everybody should be up in arms. The walls of America, the borders of America, represent, you know, people coming here looking for freedom and looking, they're dreaming in the way that King has taught us to dream about a better life. And America is a country of immigrants, and so everyone across the world, you know, are seeking to come here to better themselves. But for us as a people to stand and watch children die at the border, or to watch families be separated at the border, I don't think that we can be silent on those types of issues today. I think that everyone ought to be up in arms, because it's just not the right thing to do. And we ought to be speaking out loud and clearly on many of those types of issues.
Ruben, we just had a conversation about political tribalism and how Americans are becoming more entrenched in their own political camps, going to their own sides and blaming the other side. What would Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. say about political tribalism today?
I would think that Dr. King would tell us that we have to find a way to get along, and that we have more in common than we have differences, and that especially when it comes to adversely affecting lives of people, we have to do something about it. And on that border issue, you know, Dr. King says a quote where he says, "Our lives begin to end the day that we become silent about things that matter." And I don't think that, again, that even with the political tribalism that we have, that we ought to find a way to move things forward, but not at the expense of changing a philosophy, a critical philosophy of America. You know, Ronald Reagan said, "Take down those walls, Gorbachev," and he encouraged the walls to come down. Dr. King spoke in Berlin, and he spoke about walls, and that those walls serve as barriers to humanity. And today, you know, talking about reconstructing walls, today they still serve as a barrier to humanity. They fall counter to what we believe as not just King's dream, but as the American dream.
Well, Ruben, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Ruben Anthony Jr. is president of the Urban League of Greater Madison. The organization advocates to ensure African Americans and community members are educated, advance in their jobs, and contribute to the common good. Today, the Ideas Network is broadcasting Wisconsin's 39th annual tribute and ceremony honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., hosted by Dr. Jonathan Overby. The program includes music from the MLK Women's Mass Choir and the Victory Travelers Gospel Group. Peabody and Emmy Award-winning director, writer, and producer Rita Coburn-Wack delivers the keynote address. Tune in today at noon for this live broadcast here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show right here on the Ideas Network.